From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
East Oakland.
I live on Belvedere Street, two blocks up from Haight.
I'm from the Sunset.
The foggy inner Sunset.
I live in the Mish.
Coming up, we'll dig into the controversy surrounding waste in the North Bay.
The question for Marin County is it appropriate policy to put more garbage in a place where we're going to have rising sea levels and increased flooding?
Then one man in Berkeley tackles recycling on his own.
I don't know what garbage is. I mean, it's just a term we apply to stuff that's in a garbage can.
And we continue our series of conversations about the changing face of media in the Bay Area.
You can get updates in real time by following somebody on Twitter, and I think it's really improved the situation a great deal. There's a lot more information out there.
We're dusting off the old and making it new today on Cross Currents. We've been following a story about the possible closure of parks in San Francisco between the hours of midnight and 5 in the morning. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors is scheduled to discuss the proposal at their meeting today. Dozens of people protested in Dolores Park last night. Some of them even slept there. And some of you shared your thoughts on our tip line. Here's what listener Sergio had to say.
I'm just calling about the new law for the parks and how they're trying to implement it in Golden Gate Park, which is ridiculous. I used to live on Dolores between 18th and 19th, and people stay there all night. I called the cops many, many times. They probably have my phone number in file. And if you really want to see vandalism, go to Dolores Park in any given day. The only difference is that these guys are hipsters, and the ones in Golden Gate Park are homeless. Thank you.
End of message.
If you have thoughts to share about the proposed park closure, call our tip line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Years ago, the San Francisco Bay was ringed with landfills. Emeryville, South San Francisco, and Berkeley all had dumps by the shoreline. It's part of the region's toxic legacy. Most are now closed or have been moved further inland, away from the sensitive habitat of the wetlands. But in Marin, an old landfill not only remains, it might expand. It's at the center of a debate that's lasted nearly a decade and pitted local environmentalists against the largest waste disposal company in the country. Karina Yaffe reports.
If you drive north from San Francisco and through most of Marin County, you get to the town of Novato, turn east from Highway 101, and you run into the San Pablo wetlands, now being restored after more than a century of infill. Here, egrets, storks, and other birds fly overhead, making the area a popular destination for nature lovers. Nearby, the Petaluma River winds through the hills before connecting to the San Pablo Bay. But just steps away from this paradise lie mountains of trash, trucked in from Marin and southern Sonoma County every single day.
We get 500 to 600 tons per day of garbage. That's equivalent to about 22 big rig loads or tractor trailer loads of garbage.
Alicia McCutcheon oversees the landfill's composting operation. She says the site is so busy that it's quickly running out of space in about 10 years. That's why the owner of the site, Houston-based Waste Management, wants to take in 6 million more cubic yards of material. Put another way, at full capacity, the piles of garbage will be as tall as a 16-story building, making it the tallest structure in all of Marin. The company contends it won't make a bigger footprint because the trash will be piled at a steeper angle. Marin County approved the expansion in 2008. It also includes building a methane power plant to turn garbage into energy and a recycling facility for construction materials.
Well, the county has set forth a zero waste goal by 2025, and we need to support that goal.
Daniel North is the district manager of Redwood Landfill. He says his company's trying to do the right thing by the environment.
If Redwood Landfill were allowed to reach capacity, Marin County's waste would have to be long-hauled out of the county to a different landfill, which would result in increased cost of the ratepayers and increased carbon footprint due to the longer haul.
But a group of residents opposes the plan and has filed a lawsuit to stop the work. They say the landfill is located below sea level and is prone to flooding, meaning waste from the site can leach and contaminate the water. Brent Newell is an attorney for the No Wetlands Landfill Expansion Alliance, the group that filed the lawsuit in 2009.
When it comes down to it, the Redwood Landfill is a 1950s era unlined landfill that's located in the largest tidal marsh on the West Coast, literally located in the marsh.
Newell's group is concerned about how rising sea levels will impact the site. San Pablo Bay is projected to rise 16 inches by mid-century. That may not sound like a lot, but it means that areas close to the water will be much more likely to flood. Last December, a judge agreed with many of the alliance's arguments, and she rejected an environmental impact report on the expansion. That prompted Waste Management to file an appeal, arguing that the concerns are without merit. Ocean Reserve is an attorney representing Waste Management.
The fears that have been expressed by petitioners are not founded on any fact, and it's really more based on NIMBYism in that they would rather see their waste go outside of the county than deal with their waste locally.
Meserve says the landfill constantly monitors the site to make sure all standards are being met. It also has three levees, which can be raised as needed. And, she says, there's no alternate site for the landfill in Marin. That means the trash would have to be trucked to the East Bay, increasing greenhouse gas emissions and rates for consumers. To opponents like Brett Newell, the added emissions are worth it if it means keeping trash out of the bay.
There is no question that global warming is occurring and that sea level will rise in the future. The question for Marin County is it appropriate policy to put more garbage in a place where we're going to have rising sea levels and increased flooding?
If the expansion is granted, it means another 25 years of operations for one of the last landfills on the San Francisco Bay. If not, Marin's trash will be transported out of county. Because despite our best efforts, some trash will always exist, and it all has to go somewhere. In Novato, I'm Karina Yaffe for Cross Currents.
So where do you think our trash should go? Tell us about it on our Facebook page. We're KALW. Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Californians are pretty good about thinking twice before throwing things away. We divert more than 60% of our waste away from landfills. But what about that remaining 40%? When we imagine a world with zero waste, what would it take to get there? Arthur Boone is trying to answer those questions in his own backyard. For almost 30 years, Boone has devoted his professional life to trash. He's a recycling pioneer. KLW's Judy Silber asked him to help us see trash through his eyes for this next story from our archives.
I put in here anything that will rot. Now, that's, of course, that includes paper milk cartons, it includes your egg carton type material.
Arthur Boone and I are peering over a half-full, city-issued green cart sitting in the backyard of his Berkeley home. It's where he puts his compost. On top of rotting vegetables, he finds a sheet of mailing labels.
These are a bunch of old mailing labels, but that's all organic-based, so that can be composted.
Boone is a former minister. Big and strong, even at the age of 73. And he's still preaching. But these days, his message is all about recycling.
I don't know what garbage is. I mean, it's a term we apply to stuff that's in a garbage can. But if you look in a garbage can, it's cans, it's bottles, it's newspapers, it's magazines, it's all the things that you used to be on your desk or on your table or something like that.
Boone's journey with recycling began early in life. He remembers crushing cans during World War II to support the war effort. His mother grew up poor in Oklahoma, and her family's frugality made an impact on him.
My grandmother never threw anything away, and my mother, which I think is pretty common in the older generations, Everything that they had was fairly important to them, and they didn't just discard things easily.
Boone says after World War II, the U.S. entered an era of wastefulness. Even by 1983, recycling was still an unproven venture. But it was in that year that Boone took over the North Oakland Recycling Center.
There were about 4,000 of us at one time, all scattered around the country, mostly in liberal, progressive-type communities, where people could bring their cans and their bottles, and we would make sure that they got back into the stream of commerce, or back to people who could use them for something.
As Oakland started its own curbside recycling program, Boone sold the business. Today, he's semi-retired, but still works as a consultant. And he's still pretty obsessed with recycling.
Those are the aluminum cans from my ex-wife's house, and she knows that I'll sell them and give the money to one of our children.
Boone is a bit of an extremist.
This is kind of our sorting room here.
Boone takes me to his laundry room. Bins and plastic bags are piled haphazardly all around. There are old yogurt containers full of used batteries and metal odds and ends. He compares the disordered order to a spice cabinet, a really big one.
Cans and bottles go in here. Newspaper goes in here. This is our plastic. Then over here, what I do, this is my piece de resistance. I keep my foil in here. I take that down to Berkeley and dump it in their foil bin. Only 3% of the aluminum foil in this country is recycled. Most of it goes in the trash.
There's the problem, right there. A lot of stuff that could be recycled isn't. Berkeley only recycles number one and two plastic bottles. And that's where Boone's commitment kicks in. He rinses clean all other plastics and drives them to Superlink, a collection center in Oakland that ships recyclables to China.
So what kind of plastics are in here?
There's an oil container. Some of them don't like, some programs don't like oil container bottles. Usually I wash them out. Natalie did that. She shouldn't have.
Natalie is his girlfriend.
That needs to be better clean.
I'm Natalie Peterson. I'm very proud of what he's doing, and I want to support him however I can, but sometimes it drives me nuts.
But more attention to recycling is making a difference.
I'm learning how to segregate things according to who will recycle them. So I know about tin foil isn't the same as plastic bottles, isn't the same as broken glass, things like that.
We're all getting better, slowly. Since 1989, the amount of stuff going into landfills has come down by about 30%. That's according to California's recycling agency. But to get anywhere close to zero waste, we'll also have to start thinking about how things are made.
This is the bottom of an old lamp. There's actually three different materials in here, and the guy who wants the metal doesn't want the concrete. The guy who wants the plastic doesn't want the concrete. The guy who wants the concrete doesn't want the plastic. I mean, you know, these are the problems that we have in our society.
So lamps like these usually end up in the trash, and ultimately at landfills where they're usually buried underground. Data from the recycling agency shows that in 2008, California sent nearly 36 million tons of garbage to the landfill. That's roughly the weight of 36 million old Volkswagen bugs. Picture that, right? It's impossible. And nearly half of that incredible pile of garbage is lumber, cardboard, paper, food, leaves, grass, plastic, and glass, all of which could have been recycled or composted. Boone and I are in Oakland's Rock Ridge District rummaging through a garbage bin. We see plastic to-go containers with smelly leftover food, a cardboard pastry box, a plastic milk bottle, paper napkins, and a tree branch. None of it belongs in the trash. Boone opens a plastic bag. Used paper towels tumble out.
You know, with a very little effort, all that stuff could go to the compost yard. But nobody wants to take the effort. So. Now, what are these? Are these shoulder pads?
Yeah,
the shoulder pads, I guess, right? I would probably take this to the East Bay Depot myself.
What's the East Bay Depot?
East Bay Depot for creative reuse. They like people to bring in things that little kids mostly can make sort of arts and craftsy stuff out of.
You're putting it in your pocket.
Yeah, well, I'll take it home. Isn't that what you would do?
Probably not. But as Arthur Boone pockets those shoulder pads, I think about how much other stuff in garbage bins all over the state will just end up in the landfill. Unless someone does something about it. In Oakland, I'm Judy Silber for Cross Currents.
Arthur Boone runs three-day recycling training programs. You can find a link to more information at our website, kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. The Bay Area's recycling consciousness takes many forms. It can be small form, like what Arthur Boone specializes in. And it can be large scale, like repurposing the old eastern span of the Bay Bridge. It can even be a virtual reuse, like what happened with San Francisco-based Current TV. Al Gore's cable network was bought earlier this year by Al Jazeera America for $500 million. And now, with a base in Current's old offices by the Giants baseball stadium, Al Jazeera America has been broadcasting for a couple of months. It's a heady expansion by the Al Jazeera network, which launched in 1996 with funding from the Emir of Qatar. And it's grown rapidly over the years, now employing over 3,000 people in more than 60 countries. One of its international correspondents is Sebastian Walker. For over a decade, he's reported from Iraq and Haiti and now works out of San Francisco on an Al Jazeera America TV program called Fault Lines. As part of our series about the changing face of news media, KALW's Ben Trefney asked Walker what's different about reporting around the world today.
Well, I think it's changed massively over the course of my career. I started off with the Iraq War. I was a news reporter on the ground. I was basically what's known as a stringer, somebody who is a local hire that runs around, reporting the bare facts of a story for a news agency. I worked for Reuters news agency based in Baghdad. It was one of the first jobs that I had. And at that time, the internet wasn't really as developed and sophisticated as it is now. So the reports that I was filing were often down the phone with people typing away on a keyboard at the end of the phone. There was no, smartphone access or way of sending the story. Sometimes I went to a local internet cafe with a very dodgy connection to file this story. But I think in the time that since then, the conflicts that have come subsequently have been much more covered by bloggers and people able to file their stories very quickly with very little equipment. And I think that's really revolutionized the way that these wars are reported and really made it much easier for people to get out there and become journalists and actually have that news reported immediately and to much more people than ever was possible before.
So has that then, it brings up a couple questions for me. One is, if it's limited, then the number of people who are working in that industry, because it can be reported so much more quickly and perhaps comprehensively because you could turn it around so much faster, but also then who it is who's reporting on these conflicts, say, as we saw with the Arab Spring, for example, there was a lot of people who were on Twitter, for example, sharing stories. So how have those effects manifested?
Definitely. I think it's democratized the information. I mean, people can just go out there and do it. You can do things that were only available to a very small number of people in the past. But I think also what it's opened up is the citizen reporting from, these cities like Cairo or Benghazi. When these revolutions are happening, you can get updates in real time by following somebody on Twitter. And I think it's really improved the situation a great deal. There's a lot more information out there. But I guess sometimes also we may get to a point where there's so much volume of material that Sometimes you get lost in the detail and it's very difficult to actually get a real sense of the story. So I think at some point it will return back and people will start to kind of be more interested in more conventional reporting in the past. But at the moment, it's just, you know, for the situation that people on the ground go through with getting the news out there, it's just made things so much more easier. And you see this new generation of war reporters now going to these cities and covering these conflicts. I remember when I went to Baghdad when I was 25, and a lot of people were saying this was, you know, a very foolhardy thing to do. This, you know, there was a small group of us living in a house in the middle of Baghdad, putting out a newspaper called the Baghdad Bulletin. It was an English language newspaper. And at that time, the war had just finished. The invasion was maybe 2 or 3 weeks old. And we were catching taxis around the city, reporting on essentially local news and printing this newspaper with a circulation of around 10,000. And it was something that was criticized by a lot of the more established journalists, saying that, you know, without the relative experience of reporting from that kind of a situation, you really shouldn't be there. That's the risk that's not worth taking. But then when you look at what happened in Libya, there's a whole slew of young 20-something reporters, photographers that just went out there with, you know, small cameras, smartphones, laptops, and just did the kind of work that very established correspondents would do in the past. And it's definitely changed things. And I think in some respect, there's no going back.
That's Sebastian Walker. He is a foreign reporter working with Al Jazeera America. I've heard criticism of coverage of the Arab Spring when it was first starting up, especially in Cairo, actually, where there were reporters who were talking about and then referring to people who were tweeting regularly about what was happening. But the criticism that I saw was that the people who were tweeting were those who had access to smartphones and technology, and that was a very limited portion of the population. Therefore, it was a limited perspective that they were gathering and reporting as if it were the entire country. Have you had thoughts about this?
That's a really interesting question, yeah. And I think that's something that often does get lost when you see, let's say, Western news organizations reporting on these revolutions, say in Iran, for example. I think Iran's a very good example of that, that there was this huge amount of information on Twitter and on Facebook, and, you know, it looked, if you were following those sources of information, like there was an overwhelming support for, you know, anti-government protest and for revolution. And yeah, I do think you really need to bear in mind that this is, you know, the more, I guess, essentially middle class sector of the population that has access to those tools. So you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's, you know, the overall perspective of the street. I mean, this is something that the U.S. Policymakers are confronted with all the time, the State Department, and, you know, trying to get a sense of how much support and what should the U.S. policy be to kind of support the revolutions that they see happening on the street.
So what do you think the American audience wants, then? What is it that media organizations are responding to, and how and why has that changed?
Well, I first came to the U.S. to work as a journalist in January 2008 to cover the election. I was a beat reporter on the campaign trail going around when Al Jazeera's U.S. operation, for Al Jazeera English at least, was pretty new. So the whole experience of being here as an Al Jazeera correspondent was pretty different. At that time, there was a lot of stigma attached to Al Jazeera and interest in what was going on in the Middle East and how that filtered into, you know, the stories that we would do over here. For example, you know, returning troops or presidential candidates' policy on Iraq. I think times have changed and that now those issues are a lot more important to Americans.
So do you think then that there's more global curiosity at this point in 2013 than there was back then, 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, versus, say, interest in celebrity sightings and things like that, that perhaps more news organizations are turning to?
I think so, and that's what I hear from the people that I meet on the road when we go around and film stories within the U.S. There's definitely seems to be...
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they?
Well, certainly I think there's a fatigue of the type of news that a lot of people get right now, the personality-driven talking heads, you know, often celebrity-focused type of news that you get on the U.S. mainstream networks. I think people are tired of that, and whatever side of the political divide you sit on, I think people are starting to switch off that kind of news.
That's so, not just wishful thinking on your part?
I think the numbers demonstrate that. The viewing figures are going down. The established news organizations are struggling to keep people watching this type of news. So, and I think that's recognized by those organizations too. They're changing the way that they report the news. They're bringing social media into the discussion a lot more. Certainly, I think there's an appetite for something new, something different, and, you know, a new way of doing the news and a different perspective. That's something that I've heard a lot on the road, and a lot more than when I first arrived in the country.
That was Sebastian Walker from Al Jazeera America speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can hear more conversations about the changing face of news media on our website, kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. That's all for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes David Boyer, Jeremy Dalmas, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daphne Matsiaraki, Liz Pfeffer, Stephen Short, and Mary Willis. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. This is Whiskerman from Oakland. They're playing next Saturday when they open for Con Brio and Quinn DeVoe at the Great American Music Hall. Lights go down at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.